Well, I'm really nervous talking to theoretical physicists because I'm not good at physics and I don't do theory, but I collaborate with a theoretical physicist, and so I have this experience. He works downstairs from me, being more fundamental, and so this is his perspective of my mind, you know. And so he says, you've got a lot of interesting things in there, but you've really got to clean out that closet one of these days. You know, it's just a disorganized mess. You know, and I sort of look at his mind. I open his door, and I see it's like entering the Museum of Modern Art garden. I said, that's really beautiful, but what does it have to do with reality? But then, you know, eventually we get to talk, and sometimes that's productive. So I'm hoping that's what this is what might happen here. You never know. This is the title, and the purpose of this is mostly to give you my email address because it's missing from the program. And what I'd like to cover, if I have enough time, is really just some phenomenological results on some systems that may be of interest. This is the only experimental talk of the, purely experimental talk of the day, so I hope it will be entertainment. I want to talk about complexes formed between polyelectrolytes and three kinds of colloid particles, micelles, proteins, and dendrimers, if I have enough time. So that's, I don't know if I can disgorge the entire contents of that closet, but so polyelectrolytes, this is just some taxonomy. Polyelectrolytes can be categorized as being from natural or synthetic sources, positively charged or negatively charged, and more importantly, strong and weak. And by strong, what we mean are that the charge is independent of pH, and weak means the charge is pH dependent. And since we're working in water, this is very, very important to keep in mind. Another point, since you've heard so much about DNA, that's worth emphasizing is that all the polymers, except for DNA in this picture, are flexible chains, what we call random coil chains, which no particular predisposition to any orientation. So that's really something important to keep in mind here. Now, polyelectrolytes have a lot of applications, and if you ever look at a bottle of shampoo or something, if you dare to eat food labels, you know, you read food labels, you might eat them too. But you'll see things like alginate and carrageenan and so forth. And the point is that in all of these applications, the polyelectrolyte is interacting with the surface. There's either a colloidal surface or a large surface in there, and one could almost say that the one place where we find polyelectrolytes in the absence of any surface is probably the academic research laboratory. But otherwise, mostly they're in the presence of something. So we should know a little bit about how polyelectrolytes interact with surfaces. And what I want to talk about is polyelectrolytes interacting with colloidal surfaces, if I can unpeel this slide. And Ostwald said, colloids is the world of forgotten dimensions. And I could ask who forgot them, and I'm afraid it's chemists who forgot them, at least in this country. So we're interested in, this is just a size regime, we're interested in small colloids. So they're similar in size to polymers, but they're not the same because polymers do not have an interface. There is no discontinuity. The colloids have an interface. It's a real difference. And we're particularly interested in colloidal solutions. So there's a solid or quasi-solid in a continuous liquid phase, and these are some examples of colloidal solutions, and we're interested in these ones, which are small colloid particles. So in the regime of the same size as the polymers or perhaps a little bit smaller. Now, the question is, why might we be interested in this? And our reasons for being interested really changed a lot over the years, and originally it was probably driven by, in some incoherent way, by this concept of self-organization, except that wasn't a buzzword at the time, but the idea that the micelles would organize from small surfactants and these would complex to the polymer, and then somehow this thing would know how to stop and when to stop. So that was kind of interesting. And then we began to realize there were two aspects of this. One was to figure out what the structure of these things are, and another to understand what the energetics are, what's the forces binding them together, which compelled me to attempt to look at some theory. And then we began to work on protein complexes, which has a different set of motivations, and some of them more technological, perhaps, in the regimes of immobilized enzymes and separations. And then maybe the last motivation is the fact that it's rumored that there was a reason that polymers and colloids, polymers are in University of Massachusetts and colloids are in Clarkson, and they don't mix, is this big fight was supposed to have happened between Ostwald and Staudinger 100 years ago. Ostwald said everything was a colloid, and Staudinger said no, so, you know, maybe we can have a reconciliation and bring these topics together. So what kinds of systems are we looking at? And that's a little schematic just to give you the length scales of things. And so some of these particles are quite small that I'll be talking about, dendrimers and small proteins, and some of them are rather large. And the point is that the colloid particles that I'm going to talk to you about can be either small compared to the polymer or vice versa. So we're dealing with either a ghost Hess or Hess ghost situation here. And we have to remember that sometimes the polymer is the host and sometimes it's the guest. And is that going to change things dramatically? So we can think that as we make the polymer smaller or the colloid bigger, we're going from in this direction. And here we deal with, we're looking at what you'd consider to be a picture in the domain of a question of polymer adsorption onto surfaces. And so you'd look at the colloid books and the papers by Fleer and so forth. And here, where the particles are small, you'd think, this looks like counter-ion binding. So the question we ask is, what about these poor guys in the middle? Which books do they know how to read? And, you know, when do they stop reading one and start reading the other? So, you know, we're going to see discontinuities here just because that's the way our minds function. In the Midwest, people would look at this and the expression they would use is, you shouldn't be comparing apples and oranges. That's a phrase that people like to use there. And, you know, our response to that is it's all apples. And really, the point of this picture is really to raise some questions in our minds. And the questions that should arise are, how many colloid particles bind to a polymer chain? Is the polymer chain highly extended the way I drew it, or is it collapsed? What is the dynamics of the situation? What's the residence time of these apples in Indiana? We know this is Linguini now. What's the residence time of these? Is the binding cooperative? And what's the strength of the interaction? So these cartoons are really just meant to bring up some questions that may be answerable by experiment. Now, when we started working in this business some time ago, when we looked at the literature on polymer surfactant complexes, and this was our entree into this, we saw that people had worked on the interaction of non-ionic polymers with charged micelles, particularly ionic micelles, here. It's right here. And people had worked on polyelectrolytes interacting with surfactants below the CMC, that is monomeric surfactants. And what was missing was people working with polyelectrolytes with oppositely charged micelles. You know, so that was just sort of, in the literature, this whole area was a blank. And the question was, why? And the answer was, the interactions were too strong. And you mix these guys and you get an irreversible waxy or gummy precipitate, which is most unappealing. So nobody wanted to do this. That's my guess. And so the point is, how do you modulate those interactions so you can study them? And the answer is, if you think this is primarily electrostatic, and that's what I hope to convey in this talk, then the way you would modulate these interactions is by controlling the important variables, which would be the surface charge density of the colloid particle, the linear charge density of the polymer, or the screening electrolyte. And any of these three should be able to control this interaction and modulate it and get you to a position where the interaction isn't so strong that it's irreversible, but not so weak that you can't see it. Okay? Now, how do we do this? Well, experimentally, we find the easiest way is to modulate the surface charge density of the colloid, just for technical reasons. And the way this can be done for proteins, as you just saw in the last talk, is through the carboxyl and amine groups, so via pH. With dendrimers, also by pH change, because these are ionizable groups, and with and also with some micelles. So the pH is a very nice experimental rheostat, you know, to tune up and down these charges. And with micelles, you can have mixed ionic, non-ionic micelles. You heard about that yesterday. People were using CTAB triton mixtures. That's the case. And so these are ways to control the surface charge density of the colloid particle.
But and modulate. Mainly as an aqueous solution.
These are all aqueous, absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, what polyelectrolytes are in non-aqueous media is a complicated question, so I don't want to get into it. So when we do that, then what happens in all of these systems is the following. At low surface charge density, if we measure, regardless of whether we measure the turbidity or the diffusion coefficient or the electrophoretic mobility, All of these things are constant. All of these measured quantities are constant at low surface charge density. And this little cartoon is to show you that if you're looking at scattering, you see the colloid, you don't see the polymer just because it's a very weak scatterer. If you're looking at electrophoresis, you might see both. But it's constant. It doesn't change. And then when you get to a certain colloid surface charge density, everything starts to change. Okay? Now, if you expand this region right around here, then you find that often, subsequent to that point where things begin to change, you see things with your eyes. You see bulk phase separation, and it's often irreversible. But you've got this little domain in between, sometimes little, sometimes big, in which the system is reversible. But nonetheless, things have begun to change. So this is the domain of equilibrium complex formation. And even though these systems are terribly messy, you've got this nice toolbox of all these colloid and polymer techniques. And these are just the ones that we've applied. You know, and there are lots more that we haven't applied. So even though it's a complicated system, there's lots of ways to look at it.
And I should think of sigma phi there as the gamma or precipitate.
That is the bulk phase separation point. Yes.
And what it separates into is some sort of elastic.
We'll get to that.
Right.
Maybe. Okay, so all this is very generic. Let me get a little more particular and talk about the system that we've spent most of our time with, partly by pure accident. But it turns out to be a nice one because this domain of soluble complexes is rather wide. So we have a mixed micelle formed of two surfactants. They both have hydrophobic tails, but one of them has a polar non-ionic head group and the other one has a charged head group. And so you mix them together and you get a cluster, and the driving force for mixing is very strong. They really don't want to micellize independently of each other. And the charge on this species, if we think of this as a particle, is simply dependent upon the ratio of mixing of these two. So that now is the rheostat for changing sigma, the colloid surface charge density, to a first approximation. And then this is going to interact, maybe, with this cationic polymer, which is available over a very wide range of molecular weights, is, in my opinion, not at all hydrophobic, that's an opinion, and is cheap. So it has all these virtues. And this experiment is going to be done at a wide range of ionic strains, anywhere from 50 to 1,000 millimolar. So we're just mixing stuff together. Okay? And what happens? So the experiment is one in which we start off with pure non-ionic micelles, no charge, in the presence of this polyelectrolyte, and then some salt, and of course water. Everything's in water, because we like to be able to have lunch in the lab, you know, so we only work in water. So, and then we're going to add anionic surfactant. And that's going to go into the micelle. If you don't believe me now, you will soon. And it's going to charge up the micelle. So here's this experiment. Here's the results. Very, very nice experiment. Can be done by, this was done by an undergraduate 2 weeks ago. And this is what it looks like. And you're just measuring the turbidity as a function of the mole fraction of anionic surfactant in the micelle. So to a first approximation, this should be proportional to the surface charge density of the micelle, since it's the fraction of head groups that bear a charge. So no charge here, and it's getting charged up here. Okay. And what happens, as I promised, is nothing until you get to a rather well-defined point, and then the turbidity begins to grow. And then we see this rather peculiar maximum, which I won't yet explain, but I will soon. And then this dramatic change, which was called phi before, and now it's p, but notice this extraordinarily abrupt change. That's bulk phase transition that is visually observable.
And this equilibrium for
right here, it's an equilibrium. You can go back and forth. But here, it's very, very slow. So it takes a long time to go back. And there are some interesting things phenomenologically. One is if you increase the concentration of polymer, this peak gets bigger, but none of these positions change very much. If you increase the molecular weight of the polymer, this peak grows, but these positions don't change too much. So, first point is that this critical point, which without saying what it is, really, just phenomenologically, I call Y sub C, is independent of the molecular weight of the polymer, it's independent of the concentration of the polymer, and it's independent of the surfactant concentration. Yes? As fast as you can stir, you know, so less than a second, definitely.
Even as you approach YP?
Yes. Even as you approach YP. So this point is unaffected by polymer concentration, unaffected by polymer molecular weight, unaffected by surfactant concentration, only dependent on one thing, the ionic strength. And so this is an interesting observation. This bulk phase separation point is somewhat sensitive to molecular weight and concentrations. So that's a more complex situation. Yes, it does. Yes, that's a great question, and I'll get to that, I hope, if I don't run out of time. Sure, probably will. So this raises some questions. What do these mean? What's the meaning of this microscopic and macroscopic phase change at the fundamental level? What is the structure of this so-called soluble complex? What is the structure of this, you asked about this phase that separates, which is actually a coacervate, and I'll explain what that means in 12 minutes, I think. When my cells bind, do they change? Or are they the same as free micelles? What's the dynamics of binding, and is the binding, in fact, electrostatic? So lots of questions to answer. Now, we can, and by the way, if we do dynamic light scattering to get the Stokes radius, we see a plot that really mimics the turbidity plot. And this is the plot of the Stokes radius for a polymer-free system. So it doesn't change very much. And this is the plot of the Stokes radius for the complex. And what you can see is that the diffusion coefficients show also that nothing happened below this critical point. And it says that turbidity really is looking sensitive to the size of whatever is happening, some size of something that's being formed. Now, this is the domain in which we can look at structure by those many techniques that I listed. But if we're interested in energetics, really what we have to consider is this critical value. I'm going to try to talk about structure first. So I'll try to move quickly and just give you conclusions. Dynamic light scattering shows two modes in these systems. One mode, which is the fast decay, is what you see when there's no polymer there. And it's the only mode you see when you're below the critical point. So then there's no question that this fast mode is free micelle. But when you're above that critical value of Y, you see in addition a slow diffusion, and that must be the complex. Its size is a little bit bigger than the size of the free polymer. So that suggests that maybe it's a complex that contains one polymer chain, but you can't say for sure. And it's a dynamic equilibrium because as you move back and forth in Y, you just change relative populations of these two. So this result shows that you have colloidal particles, micelles, in dynamic equilibrium with polymer and complex. Now, the dynamic light scattering doesn't give you complete information on structure, so with great pain and some time, we could do static light scattering and get this following rather interesting result, and that is the molecular mass of these complexes done in the limit of zero polymer concentration, so that you're really looking at single complexes and not aggregates, is huge. Okay, it's 10 million. The polymer is 160,000, the micelle is 190,000, but the complex is 10 million. And the radius of gyration isn't that big, you know. So the question is, how do you get this huge mass into this complex that isn't that awfully big? So that makes you think, oh, gosh, this should be some globule, although no one who isn't Russian should use that word, in my opinion. But this is some very compact state. Now, viscosity is maybe difficult to interpret, but it's the most precise method that we know in our laboratory. And the intrinsic viscosity, which is just, you can see, is just the reciprocal of the density on a molecular basis, gives you some information about density. And it says that the density of these complexes is, these are viscosities, which are the inverse of density, so the density of the complex, it's somewhat more, it's somewhat less dense than the micelle alone, but it's quite a bit more dense than the polymer from which it was generated. So now you get into this idea of this globule or some compact thing until you do electrophoretic mobility. And then what you find is that this complex has an electrophoretic mobility which is independent of the chain length, a very well-known property of polyelectrolytes, which is thought to be related to the fact that they are extended chains free draining, thank you. So how can this thing be compact and globular and free draining at the same time? And really, the question here, yes.
I had a question.
Yes.
What is the sign of mobility? Is that of the polymer or is it of the micelle?
Well, a micelle is negative, the polymer is positive, and the complex crosses zero, depending upon the charge on the micelle. So it's actually charge reversal of the complex. But anyway, these results look a little paradoxical. Viscosity is saying it's compact. Light scattering says it has this huge mass and a small volume, but the electrophoretic mobility makes it look like it's free draining. And it's actually no conflict. It's just no conflict at all. It's just a problem with the word compact, which is not a very good word. You know. So if we take a necklace and we hang steel beads from it, you know, it gets a lot of mass per unit volume, but that doesn't mean it's collapsed to a globule. Okay. So dense and compact, you know, is just not very good terms. And what we visualize is something like this, that this has a very high mass per unit contour length because of these enormous things hanging from it. So it's dense in the sense of having a large mass per hydrodynamic volume, and hence it has a low viscosity. But if we look at it far away, it could be a rather extended chain. You know, so there's no conflict. So that's what we think about the structure at the present time. Now, next question I wanted to deal with is energetics. And this is the plot you already saw. What happens as we add salt? Well, as we add salt, these critical values of YC and YV just move from left to right. And I think this may, at the moment, be intuitively reasonable, but I think if not, it will soon be. Now, we can look at how this YC depends on ionic strength. You know, so this is just phenomenology, and maybe it doesn't look like much at the moment. And so here's the experiments in which we make a mixed micelle of this surfactant, which has an anionic head group, and this one, and complex it with this polymer. We observe the critical point at which binding occurs as a function of added salt. And if we plot that, we plot the dependence of YC on added salt, then this is perfectly linear if we plot it versus ionic strength, square root of ionic strength. And we've done this with a lot of systems, and the best we can do the experiment, it's always quite linear. And there's no logs here, okay? So it's really linear. And so this seems to be an experiment that's trying to tell us something, when something turns out to be so simple. Now, so at this point, we said, well, gee, is there any theory about this sort of thing? And there is, and there has been. And the first paper we found, I think, is this lovely paper by Vajkol, who said that if you think about charged polymers in a living cell, then they're surrounded by interfaces or surfaces of all kinds. And he says that there should be a critical or a phase transition at which adsorption appears, governed by these parameters. And in our terminology, it's kappa, the ionic strength, sigma, the colloid surface charge density, and the linear charge density of the polymer. And these should dictate a critical point at which adsorption first occurs. So said Vajkol. Now, of course, he's dealing with flat surfaces, so that's a caveat at the moment. Pardon? Yes. I'm sorry. Oh, it's called math, math dot gen, and I don't know what that stands for. What is it?
J-A-B-A.
Oh, yes, thank you. Math in general. Yes, yes. Nothing I routinely read. A completely different treatment from the people at Wageningen. Very, very different model. Also gives rise to the conclusion, existence of a critical surface charge below which no adsorption occurs. From a very different approach, I think. Same sort of conclusion. And Muthu has thought about this and arrives at a similar conclusion, that there's a transition point. So some kind of phase transition, when the surface charge is high enough, the polymer absorbs. Below that point, it doesn't absorb. So for me, almost a bewildering wealth of theories. Now, where those theories differ is in the functional forms. They all say the commonsensical thing, that as kappa goes up, sigma critical should go up. You know, that's sort of intuitive. As the polymer charge gets higher, then sigma critical can get lower. You know, I mean, that's bonehead, I think, to just recognize it should be that way. But the dependences are different. You know, how the scaling with kappa are different. So if we wanted to test this experimentally, we should. It would be nice to have a system that looks something like the a little bit less messy. And so this is what we thought we needed. If we're going to have a micelle, we'd really like to have the charge groups out on the surface instead of Lord knows where, maybe buried inside someplace. So we'd like to have a micelle where the charge is on the surface. We'd like to have a micelle whose size doesn't change as we go from one ionic strength to another. That messes things up. And we'd like, and another nice feature would be one in which we really don't have to deal with mixed micelles, but just can change sigma by varying the charge through the pH. And finally, if we use carboxylate groups, then this group is its own potential probe. Now, because we can measure the pK of this group, and that directly gives us the potential as seen by a proton at that point. Okay? So the strategy is to determine the critical pH where binding occurs, convert that to a critical degree of ionization, so something like this, do that at different ionic strains. From the pK, we can, if we get pKs through titration, we can measure the effective potential at that critical point, and then through some form of the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, convert that critical potential, if we want to a critical surface charge density. So now we would get the critical surface charge density of the micelle as a function of ionic strength. Okay, and let me just show you the results of that. So it looks kind of nice, because it looks like a nice line. And you can view this as a phase diagram, because when you're up here at low micelle charge, you don't have any complexes, or at high salt. And when you cross over to here, you get complexes. And the experiments I've been describing so far are ones in which we did a constant ionic strength moving down here until we got to some critical point. But in principle, you could move either way. Now, so this says that we're getting sigma as linear with kappa, which agrees with some of those treatments, but not with others. But of course, we're dealing with a spherical surface, and maybe it's not quite flat. Now, what's the physical meaning of this, which is more, since I'm not good at math, I have to use pictures. And this is really very, it's terribly simple. And that is that when does a polymer get bound? It gets bound when enough of its charged segments are within the realm where the potential is bigger than kT. Okay, and then it will stick. But if it's not like that, it won't be bound. So what's going to be important is the thickness of this, if you like, double layer, if you want to use that word. And the thickness of this double layer really just depends upon two things, the charge surface charge density and the screening length. If what I'm saying by the thickness of the double layer is where in space is the potential bigger than kT. Okay, so this right away tells you that there should be this compensating interaction between ionic strength and surface charge density. And that's what's the same about the two ends of this plot. We have to ask, what's the same along here? And this is a picture that says, what's the same? What's the same is that the potential has come out, like if it was one of Barry's pictures that shows, you know, the potential around the proteins, come out far enough to trap the polymer, regardless of whether you're here or here. And it certainly doesn't tell us why it's linear. Yes?
But this picture would have a molecular weight dependence, because no, molecular weight
no,
was very small.
No.
It would just
okay,
pump
that's great. Thank you. There's no effect of polymer molecular weight on the space bounding. What that means is that we really can't do these experiments when the molecular weight gets this small. This is awfully small, because this thing is only 5 or 10 nanometers. So, you know, this would be a molecular weight of maybe 1,000, which is hardly a polymer. So when we get up to where we do the experiments, which is 5,000 to a million, no molecular weight effect can be seen anymore. Now, one thing that we can do, since we know the potential at these different ionic strengths, then if we know the surface potential and we know the ionic strength, we know what the potential decay curve looks like. And then we can prepare from experimental information is the surface potential at the critical point at different ionic strengths. So each experiment leads to one decay curve. Okay, so when we prepare those decay curves, what we find is they all cross. Now, this crossing is a little subtle, you know, and if you're, you could say, well, it's a little fragile, but for many different systems, we've seen that crossing point. And I can't say exactly what it means, but I can say what it says is that when the potential 8 angstroms away from the micelle surface is 9 millivolts or more, we get binding. Now, that's just a restatement of these decay curves. Mm-hmm. Yes?
What is the distance
along the chain? 7 angstroms. As the crow flies, so to speak. Yeah. So this is a, now that, this is sort of what I'd call an intermediate charge density polyelectrolyte. But below the condensation limit. Okay, so that's all I want to say for the moment about energetics. And make some a very quick comment about dynamics. As a chemist, I have to go to these ACS meetings, you know, and they're really dreadful. It's 12,000 people. And I don't like to go there, but I have to go there because, you know, I get jobs to do. And there was a meeting in Orlando, and I said, why am I here? And I met Muthu, you know, and he said, I've done these simulations of spheres interacting with oppositely charged polymers, and these simulations show that at high salt, it just bounces off. But as I lower the salt, I start to see some resonance time. But then if I lower the salt anymore, the resonance time is infinite. Is there any experiment that would have, you know, relate to this? And the next day, I talked to a colleague of mine named Marishima, who's very good at putting fluorescent probes on polymers. And he said, I've done some of the experiments that, you know, you like to do, and I put a fluorophore in the polymer and a quencher in the micelle, and I've got bad news for you, and that is, below what you call the critical point, I already see some energy, some quenching. You know, so I ran back to Muthu and I said, yeah, you know, we can do that. Now I know why I go to these ACS meetings, because among 12,000 people, there's a chance that you're going to find two that are worth talking to. Pardon? This was about 20% on a percentage basis. So the point is that this experiment, this dynamic fluorescence experiment, can tell you something about the, if you like, the resonance time or the time in which the micelle is available for quenching. And this is the result. So this is the this is the resonance time measured in Osaka versus this what we call Y, but I try to explain is the micelle surface charge density, and it undergoes 2 orders of magnitude change over a very small change in Y. So there, I like this because it's rare for me to see simulations and some experiments coming close to each other and saying something about the same thing, about dynamics. Okay, now I wanted to talk about some other things besides micelles. Why would we leave the world of micelles? And that's because there are lots of questions here. They're not really particles. They're dynamic. How do we know they don't change when they bind to the polymer? Maybe they get bigger. Maybe they get smaller. Maybe they polarize. And what the hell is the surface of a micelle anyway? We certainly don't know. I mean, it's fluctuating. It's dynamic. It's what kind of surface is it? So we'd like to have something that's a real particle. So then we go out of the frying pan into the fire. And now we have a real particle, but of course, as was just explained to you, and finally I know why blue is positive and red is negative. I never knew before. So this is serum albumin, and now we're going to look how at this interaction with a polycation. So very simple experiment done by colleagues in Kyushu, in which we have the polymer and the protein, same old polymer, and the protein I just showed you. And we're going to add base to it and raise the pH. And so it's going to go from being positive to negative. And we're going to look at the turbidity and the scattering intensity. And we can even look at the size of particles with a confocal laser microscope. And this is what they see. And as the pH gets raised, things begin to happen. And there's a point at which the scattering intensity begins to change. And this is the point, the onset of complex formation. So now we call it pH critical, and it's just like Y critical. It's the point at which the protein begins to have enough negative charge, or if you like, not too much positive charge, to bind to this polycation. And then there's this dramatic change in turbidity, which is this bulk phase separation. You know, so being armed with all kinds of incorrect misconceptions from the previous work, we filed ahead. But there are some other reasons for being interested in this kind of thing. And one is the notion that if you have two different proteins and they bind to a polyelectrolyte, maybe you can separate them in a 50-gallon reactor, even. And another one is that if this protein happens to be an enzyme, is this a way to immobilize enzymes? So there's a variety of interests. Yes? I'll show you that very soon. So this also raises lots of questions about structure and cooperativity. And the complex issue of energetics, since as you just saw from the last talk, protein charge distributions are highly heterogeneous. The fact that these are forming complexes was shown 10 years ago by an undergraduate in my lab who did dynamic light scattering of this mixture as a function of pH. At low pH, you only see one decay mode. It's the fast decay due to the diffusion of the protein. The polymer doesn't scatter enough to be seen. It's invisible. You raise the pH, the protein gets negatively charged, and now you see a second decay mode. It's slow, and it's the complex. So complexes are being formed. And you could do this by lots of techniques. Now, you can show this in the form of a phase diagram, that at high pH, you have phase separation to form coacervates. I'll explain what those are in a few minutes. I know, I'm watching the clock. At a lower pH, you have soluble complexes, and down here you have nothing. Now, the pH is a nice experimental variable, but that's what you adjust in the lab, but its physical meaning should be the protein charge. So let's take this away and put the protein charge there instead. And lo and behold, a very nice result, but very strange. And that is that we see this linear dependence of critical protein charge on kappa, just sort of like the micelle. But truly, well, this is just from titration data. So we know the critical pH and titration curve. Either we do it ourselves or we go to Tanford. But the weird thing is it goes right through zero. And it goes through zero without a flinch, as if zero meant absolutely nothing. So why is it that the isoelectric point means absolutely nothing to this polymer? And a little conversation with Giovanni made it all clear. And he said, the polymer is going to find where it wants to bind. It's going to absorb on the surface it likes. And so it doesn't care anything about the isoelectric point. It's absolutely meaningless to it. Now, that explains why this can go right through zero, but it doesn't explain, and we still don't understand, why if this is being governed by a local charge, which you saw very nicely in Barry's talk, why that local charge should be a linear function of the global charge or the net charge.
Isn't it a little bit glib, Yoni's argument, because I can have different numbers of proteins than micelles, and I could then still make isoelectric complexes by...
Okay, so this is now no micelles, it's proteins and polyelectrolytes, so no more micelles.
I still could imagine that I can make neutral complexes which would precipitate at the isoelectric point, right?
No. The proteins are soluble, fully soluble at the isoelectric point, and the complexes are soluble at the isoelectric point, so charge neutrality does not ensure... phase separation, any more than the net charge of a protein being zero ensures phase separation. Proteins are very nicely soluble when they have zero net charge. That is well known. So this is a puzzling result. So I'm just borrowing from Delphi, which you just heard about, to show that even when the protein has a net positive charge, I better remember positive is blue, it has negative regimes. And this is where the polymer wants to go, to these regions. It doesn't really particularly want to bind here. It doesn't need to see the whole thing. If it sees that, it's good enough. Now, what happens as we raise the pH a little bit more? I'm getting quickly. What the confocal microscope shows is nothing until you get to pH 7, and then you begin to see things. Okay, now what are these things that you begin to see? This is a video-enhanced fluorescence microscopy done with Paul Russo. And what you see are little droplets. And they're wiggling around. Oh, my God. That's just an artifact of our copy machine or printer. But what is real is these little yellow dots. And yeah. No. Because these move. See, these move. The other ones don't move. These move. So when you, It's too much work to make sure a video camera's here and stuff, but, you know, the videos show these things moving around due to Brownian motion. And they're about a half a micron to a micron. At least that's what they look like. I'm not saying what the resolution of this is. And with time, or with a change in pH, these little droplets get bigger, and eventually they fall. And these big ones that are on the order of 10 micrometers have fallen to the bottom of the slide and sort of flattened out, but these little ones are still, you know, bobbling around. Now, well, that's fun to look at. You know, we look at them for a long time because we love to watch these guys wiggling around. Like Oprah, and we think we've created life. But what's really interesting is that if the protein in there happens to be an enzyme, the enzyme is active. So we can do experiments in which we know that all of the enzyme is inside those droplets. And this is a case of trypsin where the activity is reduced. We think it's reduced because it digests itself in these. But if we do it with alcohol dehydrogenase, actually the activity is enhanced. I can't say why, but with all of the enzyme inside these little droplets, the activity is enhanced. There's no enzyme outside the droplets. We do this by having excess polymer. And that's kind of cool because you can now think of these droplets as little enzyme microreactors. And it doesn't seem to be any problem with substrate going in and product going out. These things don't slow down. So this is why we get interested in these droplets, which are coacervates. Now, what is a coacervate? Well, you know, I can't find it in any of my chemistry books. So I had to go to my son's 10th grade biology book. Now, there it is, in the 10th grade. And it tells him how to make a coacervate. It says, mix gelatin and gum arabic, adjust the pH, look under the microscope, and you'll see little droplets. You know, but sometime after the 10th grade, you know, it's gone. It's forgotten. So that's what we're looking at. This is a liquid-liquid phase separation to form a second aqueous phase that's very concentrated in macromolecules, dense, optically clear, and viscous. And it was known, it's been known for 100 years probably that these things occur. So we're interested in them for a number of reasons. For one of the things I mentioned, it's quite interesting to think why an enzyme is active inside these things. Another is that it's a challenge to me to understand why and how these things form when they do. Now, with coacervates, it's a little more difficult to do experiments because we're kind of limited. We can't use all those techniques. But one thing we can do is centrifuge these little droplets and get several milliliters of coacervate, and then we can do some things with that. And one thing that we could do is rheology. And so this was done in Bayreuth with the help of Heinz Hoffmann. And the very interesting thing is that the viscosity is frequency independent over the whole range of frequencies. And that was surprising to us because with our picture of these complexes as being something like a network of polymer chains glued together by proteins, we thought this should be a network and should have some elasticity, and it has none. There's no evidence of elasticity at any of these frequencies. So that was kind of surprising. Now the other thing we can do is measure the diffusion coefficient of proteins within these coacervates by fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. Once again, we're indebted to the help of Paul Russo, who showed us how to do this, in which one creates a pattern of bleached lines on a coacervate droplet or glob. First we label the protein with a fluorophore, fluorescein isothiocyanate, and then bleach it. And then after the laser is taken away, the fluorescence gets recovered only by diffusion, because what is bleached can never unbleach. And this way, it's possible to measure the diffusivity of the protein in this stuff that looks like goo.
I mean, it's correct to think of this as a dense assembly of these complexes.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, we thought it would be nice to enhance this experiment by not only doing it with protein, but also with another molecule that's the same size as the protein, which has absolutely no reason to want to interact with anything. And this is a densely branched non-ionic polysaccharide called phycol. And we can't imagine why this would want to interact with a polyelectrolyte. It's just like starch, you know, just neutral saccharide groups. And very nicely for us, this will go into the coacervate also, so we can do a separate experiment in which some small fraction of these proteins are replaced with fluorescent phycol and measure its diffusion coefficient in this. So it's sort of a companion study. And the results are reported here as the diffusion coefficient of the probe in the coacervate relative to its diffusion in free solution. And so for protein in coacervate, its diffusivity drops by only a factor of 7, which is not a lot. And then rather remarkably, exactly the same thing happens for phycol. Its diffusion coefficient drops by a factor of 7. So this is a very interesting conundrum, I think. And that is, polyelectrolyte and protein must interact, otherwise why would anything happen? You know, we're getting a coacervate. And yet that interaction is invisible in the diffusion coefficient. It's moving around freely and happily as if nothing was holding it in place. But the what is? Oh, yes, yes, yes. I'm about to do that. Okay, so the viscosity of this coacervate is about 600 millipascals. But the microviscosity, which you could get from applying Stokes' law to the measured diffusion coefficient, is very small. You know, so there's this huge difference between the bulk viscosity as measured with a viscometer and the viscosity as seen by this probe as it moves around, so-called microviscosity. If I think I have maybe 5 minutes to say something about dendrimers. So what's wrong with proteins? Why should we go on beyond proteins? Well, as I mentioned, for comparison with theory, it's very hard because the structures are so irregular, both with respect to charge distribution and geometry. And then another reason you can read here. So if we wanted to make comparisons with theory, what we'd really like to have are spheres that are geometrically symmetrical, uniform surface charge density, controllable size, and readily controllable surface charge. So these are called dendrimers. And this is a picture of one group of dendrimers, ranging in size from a few angstroms to maybe a diameter of about, maybe this one has 4 or 5 nanometers. And all of the charges, carboxylate groups, once again red, are on the surface and not inside. There are different opinions on that matter. It's spherically symmetrical. When we get to the big ones, they're rather rigid. They're not really terribly floppy. So we can control the charge on them via the pH because these carboxylate groups can be protonated or deprotonated. And so we can vary the radius, we can vary the charge, we can measure the charge.
How close what's the average distance between the nearest neighbors?
They get very, very tightly packed, and so it's on the order of a few angstroms when we get to high generations. So, for example, let's see. For generation of 5, there's about, or the next one up, 5.5, there would be almost 1,000 carboxyl groups with a radius of 4 nanometers. Enormous charge densities.
And I assume very complex titration behavior then.
Not necessarily. Okay, so where are these dendrimers on the scale of things? Now, they're smaller than proteins. They're a lot smaller than particles, real colloidal particles. But the question that we could ask here is a dendrimer a big counterion or a small colloid? So, you know, which are the right theories to look at? Now, if we do sort of the classical experiment that I described to you, where we just charge up the dendrimer and look at its diffusivity, which here I've reported as Stokes' radius, it's constant until we get to some critical pH, and then it changes. So there's a well-defined binding point. And even for the smallest dendrimer, there seems to be this discontinuity at low salt. But the protein also showed a discontinuity, but maybe not quite as abrupt. What is different here is that either we don't see soluble complexes, or if they do form, they go very quickly to phase separation. So that's why it looks so abrupt, if that was the question. But at high salt, only the largest dendrimer shows this discontinuity. So it makes me sort of think that, well, gee, at high salt, these dendrimers look like counterions, but at low salt, they can look like colloids, which I think has, the question is really how many polymer groups do they bind to at once. Now, these are the dendrimers that we've actually fixed on, made by George Newcomb. And these guys are nice because they don't have any titratable groups inside. They're all on the surface. The other ones I showed you had some rather vexing titratable groups in the interior. And what you can see, as I was just answering the, Barry's question, is that when we get to large dendrimers, they have an extraordinarily large number of ionizable groups packed onto a rather small surface. You know, so you'd think they, I mean, you couldn't make these unless you made them in the unionized state first and then did something to them. And they show a rather well-defined point of complexation. So can we get the same kind of result for these two in terms of the interdependence of the critical charge density on ionic strength? And the answer is it looks very similar, that the critical surface charge density looks like it's approximately linear with kappa. And we've done some work with Jerry Manning to find ways to rationalize this through another approach. Now, one point here is that we can get these charge densities in two ways. Either, if we know the potential, we can convert that to a charge density through the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, or we could just calculate it geometrically. We could just know the number of groups we've titrated and the size, and you'd think those two would agree, and they don't for the larger dendrimers. And the reason they don't agree is as follows. If we do exactly the same experiment with, instead of sodium chloride, tetramethyl ammonium chloride, then they agree perfectly. Yeah. So why? So the answer is that sodium binds to the to these dendrimers because they're carboxylate groups, which everybody knew about 30 years ago, that sodium binds to carboxylate groups, but a lot of us forgot. So then we have to do these experiments in tetramethyl ammonium. So the last result I want to show you, I promise, is what happens now if we vary the polymer linear charge density, which was a question that came before. So to do that, we make copolymers where one repeat unit is neutral and the other one is charged. Okay, so synthetically, we can vary the polymer linear charge density all over the map. And then we can now determine the colloid surface charge density as at the critical point as a function of two things, as a function of ionic strength and the polymer linear charge density, both. And try to put that together in one plot. So these are data for copolymers interacting with dendrimers, but I also threw a result for polymers interacting with micelles on the same plot of the product of colloid surface charge density times polymer linear charge density versus kappa. Now, I have to express a lot of caution here because I said something critical about log-log plots, and here I am presenting one. So there's huge experimental error buried in this plot, and I take this with caution. But, of course, we're looking for behavior that is rather universal is what we're after. And I'm trying to say this is not only micelles, it's not only proteins. So to conclude, first point is that we really, in systems like this, we have to think of phenomena occurring at a lot of length scales. So locally, we have, for example, carboxyl groups on the colloid interacting with charge groups on the polymer at the angstrom scale. It's presumably there's phase transition-like behavior because a bunch of polymer segments bind together. then if we think about what's the structure of these complexes, we're looking at things on the scale of tens of nanometers. And then if we start to think about phase separation, we're looking at phenomena that occur on the scale of micrometers. So this means that there's a very wide range of techniques involved to probe these different length scales, which isn't so hard. The hard thing is to actually try to be able to think on these different length scales. And if we don't think on all these length scales, then this is our situation. So you probably all know that story. And so there are, if we only did experiments by one technique, we'd say the elephant is a rope or something hard and sharp, and we'd be in this position of describing the system this way. So we're forced to use a lot of different methods and take a little extra time. So thank you for your attention.
Few questions. I have 33. Start with Tom.
Do you know that those complexes involve only one polymer, or have you deduced how many polymers are in a complex?
It's really hard to prove that they only involve one polymer chain, but if we go towards the limit of zero polymer concentration, we reach a certain domain of polymer concentrations in which we don't see changes anymore in the hydrodynamic radius or the scattering intensity. So reaching a limit of low polymer concentration at which those things are no longer dependent on polymer concentration indicates that you can find a range of low polymer concentrations in which the complexes contain only one chain. Is that, should I say that differently? Is that clear?
You still have the complexes, but the properties don't change. Is that what you're saying?
The fact that complex structure is independent of polymer concentration in the low polymer concentration regime suggests that these are unipolymer complexes. Certainly, as you raise the polymer concentration, there's clear evidence that these begin to aggregate and you've got several polymer chains together.
Good. If for some obscure reason they like pairing the polymers up, you couldn't rule that out.
Yes.
You are forgetting phase boundary.
Those phase diagrams that I drew are completely independent of polymer concentration and total surfactant concentration.
Well, you have mentioned that your colloid could be seen as big containers. A lot of phase diagrams have been obtained for mixture of polyethylene and
In the very beginning of the talk, I said that when colloid particles get small enough, they might start to look like big counter ions. But none of the ones that I was showing, except for maybe the smallest dendrimers, really should be considered to be in that range. So I don't think that these micelles, proteins, or dendrimers are simply big counter ions. I don't think they behave that way. You're the... They repel. These micelles are all charged. Okay? So they're repulsive. And you can see that in the osmotic coefficient. You know, the
yesterday we saw several times the figure of DNA in the viral particle bursting out at their Did you comment on the mechanism of protecting DNA in light of your work?
No.
At the beginning, your first view graph sort of drew this kind of region of the non-ionic polymers, plus the micelles, all these different regions. Now, can you contrast the systematics of these kind of polyethylene complexes with the situation where you have, say, the Kaban situation, where you have polyoxides plus micelles, a non-ionic? I mean, some of the stuff is similar, but are the details?
Yeah, right.
Is different than
Okay. Well, what's the same is at the structural level, we're asking the same kinds of questions. How many micelles bind to the polymer chain? What's the radius? So all the techniques and maybe the conceptual basis, the scattering, you interpret the scattering similar ways, are quite similar. The difference is that in the Kaban case, the driving force can't be electrostatic. I don't think anybody, I think there's a lot of debate about what the driving force
is. Would you tell us what that case is?
The Kaban case?
Yes.
I'm sorry. That's a non-ionic...
the chalk is another.
If I had a marker, I'd be in great shape.
I can give you a marker.
Thank you.
What color do you want?
Anything other than pale yellow.
Well, I have a pale yellow, too. Take a blue, which is a more allowable one.
Okay, so that's... Okay, so it's this polymer, which is non-ionic, but hydrophilic, so it's water-soluble, interacting with micelles of this surfactant, which is sulfonate groups all over the surface. And they do form complexes. They do not stay separate under any conditions, whereas ours do. And the question was, what's to compare and contrast? Professor Pink has asked me to compare and contrast these two cases. And so the answer was the energetics must be very different here, but the structural information, the way you go about looking at it, is the same.
Thanks.
Thank you.